This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Children's Theater, presenting the world premiere of The Giver, the story of a boy learning of the tragic sacrifices his community has made for safety and security. The Giver runs March 5th, 11th, 12th at 2 p.m. at Keller Auditorium, 222 Southwest Clay. Tickets at 503-228-9571 or Ticketmaster.com. Appropriate for ages 10 and up. Information about The Giver at octc.org.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo de Landeros Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, President Bush's 2007 budget will affect women inmates and children in Oregon. We have a live interview with the father of Deontay J. Keller, who was shot by Portland police officer 10 years ago. And immigrant advocates plan two big events in Portland in the Portland area this weekend.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,286 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,153 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, February 27, 2006. I'm Noah Eaton.
And I'm Andy Seaton. Daycare workers around the state are mobilizing for union representation. That's since Governor Ted Kulongoski signed an executive order February 13th authorizing collective bargaining for the 6,000 state-listed child care workers who watch three children or fewer. Service Employee International Union, the largest state workers union in the state, spent a year and a half persuading more than a half the qualifying child care workers to sign cards authorizing the union to represent them. With the issuance of the executive order, the union will now seek to negotiate better terms for child care workers and the children and parents they serve. SEIU's success came after its rival, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, organized the 4,500 state-licensed child care workers. Those workers watch larger groups of children in their own homes. Kulongoski paved the way for that group to unionize with a similar executive order issued in September.
Families of Oregon soldiers killed in the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan are joining together to launch a pro-war activist group called Oregon Families United. The group includes mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, and children of Oregon active military and guardsmen lost over the last 3 years. This comes 1 week after the Rural Organizing Project sponsored a Gold Stars Family for Peace speaking tour through rural Oregon communities. The Associated Press reports the pro-war families from across the state will be joined by other families with loved ones serving in Iraq, veterans of the Iraq conflict, and other troop supporters. Learn more about the National Families United at www.familiesunitedadmission.com. Please note that the opinions of this group do not reflect the opinions of this highfalutin community radio station.
February 28, 2006, marks the 10-year anniversary of the death of Deontay J. Keller, who was shot in the back and killed by Portland police officer Terry Krueger. Keller's father has created an unusual memorial, the Deontay J. Keller Community Training Center. The center opens in Portland tomorrow night. Here with us is Mr. Joe Bean Keller to talk to us about his son and its new institution. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Andy.
So can you tell us a little bit about what happened to your son?
Well, early morning, February 28, 1996, my son was driving down the street in a car. I had stopped at the store, and there was an incident, I guess, that had happened, a drive-by shooting that happened earlier that day. And they were looking for a particular car, and I guess they seen the car that my son was in, and at the time they seen it, they followed the car. Then he going down interstate, got to the corner, made a right, and he jumped out the car. Okay, the car that he was in was not the car that was in the drive-by shooting. they say it was, but there was never any proof exactly because it never got to that point. But he jumped out the car and he took off running because he didn't have any driver's license and he didn't want to go to jail, basically. And Officer Terry Krueger shot him in the back. And he continued to run, I guess, and then he passed out in a yard, in the backyard of a house. And basically they found him back there. They went and checked him, handcuffed him. He was still living. This was approximately 2 o'clock. And then they called for medical at approximately 2:20 when medical got there because they were only right around the corner because it happened off the interstate and going. They didn't let the medical go in until 3:30. So basically they let him bleed to death. And the autopsy report says that he died at 2:45.
Mm. All right. Over the years, you've done a lot of work around the issue of police accountability in Portland. Right. You started you started one of the first websites on the issue. Can you tell us a little bit about your community activism?
Well, it's kind of, once Deontay was killed, it kind of kept me in the loop, and I'd already been an activist as well before that as well. But then what happened was my bass player and personal friend, Kenny James, his daughter Kendra, was killed by the police. And so that took me into another arena in which I had to, basically, I was there with him, supporting him, being there with the family, and being a voice pretty much. And then recently, right after that, then James Gerhard Perez got killed, and that's a family friend as well, too. So it's kind of, I guess, there must have been a reason for me having the insight to be the person in which I am and so forth, because somebody needs to continue to put the pressure on the police, let them know, and the DA shrunk, that we can't continue to keep having these things happening and stuff without having any kind of recourse, because every time someone gets shot, the grand jury always says it's a justifiable homicide.
All right. So let's. Can you tell me a little bit about the Deontay J. Keller Community Training Center?
What it is a computer lab, actually a training center where we're going to be teaching entrepreneurship skills from plumber skills, electrical skills, as well as music, and we have some computer people that's going to be in there doing computer training. And one of the key focuses and what's going to be focused on is a accredited GED program, because and since there's a lot of older people that don't have GEDs, mm-hmm. and they're too afraid to go to school because they don't want to go to college, because it's kind of embarrassing to go and sit in a college room at age of 45 or 50 or something, and when you're in there with young kids and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so this is going to be an intimate space in which they can come, where there won't be no more than 10 to 12 people at a time actually going through the GED program.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Keller.
All right. Thank you.
That was Joe Bean Keller, a local activist. The dedication reception for the Deontay J. Keller Community Training Center is tomorrow, February 28th, from 4 until 7 p.m. The center is located at 2627 Northeast MLK Boulevard on the lower level. And for more information, go to ppbcomplaint.com and click on the Untold Story, which has all of the documentation that was never released during the investigation. Or you can give us a call, give them a call at 503-281-0644.
Oregon's metro areas rank poorly as job creators, according to America's best-performing cities by the Milken Institute. Salem was 100th, the Portland area was 95th, and Eugene-Springfield was 96th in the most recent ranking. Portland's and Salem's rankings both were down from 2004, and Eugene's was higher. The ranking is based on 9 categories that attempt to quantify an area's short and midterm job growth and the portion of its economy attached to the high-tech industry. Salem ranked low in job growth in the percentage of high-tech workers from July 2004 to July 2005. It ranked better, 34th, in job growth from 2003 to 2004. To see the whole report, go to www.milkeninstitute.org. The institute is named after its founder, Michael Milken, who served a prison term for finance-related crimes. Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia, describes him as a man who almost single-handedly created the junk bond industry.
President Bush's 2007 budget makes big cuts to Head Start program, although experts say that funding is critical for vulnerable kids in Oregon and across the country. That includes a one-of-the-kind program at Oregon's only women's prison that gives some inmates with young children a much better shot at successful family life after their release. KBOO's Spencer Raymond reports.
75 babies have been born to inmates at Oregon's only female prison since it opened 4 years ago, according to the Oregon Department of Corrections. Nearly 75% of the 1,000 women incarcerated at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility are mothers, many of them serving times for crimes related to substance abuse. Some inmates there have been working with a unique Head Start program that allows them to bond with their children, as well as develop relationships with the foster parents in a classroom setting away from the prison visiting room. Jerry Alcock, with Community Action Washington County, says the benefits for mothers and children are deep and long-lasting.
For female prisoners, the number one predictor of staying out of prison after they've been in is a healthy, strong experience parenting their children once they're out of prison.
Alcock says the Head Start prison program, the only one like it in the nation, targets children up to 3 years old and mothers who are scheduled for release. President Bush's proposed 2007 budget includes major cuts to Head Start to pay for military, tax cuts, and other administration priorities which could threaten the program. Alcock says, in addition to helping infants and toddlers stay in better relationships with their mother, the Head Start program teaches inmates strong parenting skills, which many have never had the opportunity to experience.
For those women, it's not just about getting to see their kids or getting to be a mom when they get out. It's about stopping sometimes many generations of abuse and neglect.
Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Spencer Raymond, KBOO News.
We're thousands of miles away from New Orleans, but nevertheless, the Portland police are establishing a Mardi Gras curfew. Police Commander Dave Benson told reporters the crackdown is aimed at partially clad teenagers who are drawn downtown. Strangely, Benson says a program is started by young women exposing themselves. He added that then the young women are swarmed by men. Police will enforce a 9:15 p.m. curfew for children under the age of 14 and 10:15 p.m. for kids 14 and older. Benson says if you have youngsters, the best bet is to keep them home tomorrow night.
Save the date, Sunday, March 21st, but don't plan to be somewhere. Rather plan to get the hell out of or near Oregon. That's when federal officials plan to implode the now-defunct Trojan nuclear plant. A spokesman for PGE, which owns the cooling tower, says the 41,000-ton tower, which sputs off steam from the electric plant before its 1992 shutdown, was never exposed to radioactivity. Therefore, no significant radioactivity will be released by its demolition. Scott Burnell, a spokesman for the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission, told the Longview Washington Daily newspaper, quote, any radiological contamination would be so minute that it would present no public danger, no danger to the public safety, unquote. Officials say the all radioactive waste that still left the Trojan is sealed in 34 concrete casks on the property, about 900 feet to the tower's north, awaiting the long-delayed opening of Nevada's Yucca Mountain or other federal nuclear depository.
This week, immigrant advocates are holding two big events. Wednesday, March 1st, is an educational forum on the history of immigrants in the United States. Then Saturday, March 4th, is a street march through downtown Portland. Earlier today, Lisa Loving spoke with Casey Jama of the Center for Intercultural Organizing. He had this to say.
Basically, we're trying to link what it was happening in the past to the current situation that the immigrant refugee community are facing in our country.
Mr. Jama, we read a lot in the daily newspaper around refugee issues for guest workers coming from Spanish-speaking countries like Mexico or Guatemala or El Salvador. We hear less about issues for refugees and new immigrants coming from other parts of the world. Do you feel that there are different issues that people will be discussing at this event?
No, actually, I don't think so. I think overall, the immigrant and refugee community, whether they are from Latin America or Africa or Asia, we are facing the same issue, and I think that there's a public perception that tends to think that there's a different issues, but reality is that being to a new country, our issues and our challenges and our aspirations are all the same, and I think that's something that we need to make sure it's clear.
So your event that's coming up, the Immigration Forum, who is that for? And who will you be welcoming at that event?
Well, first of all, there's a two events, as you said, that will be taking place. The Wednesday, March 1st public forum is basically a prelude to our March 4th rally, where, you know, immigrant and refugee community and allies and almost everyone, that we are welcoming and inviting everyone to participate this march. Because I think the issues that right now in our country, especially the issues of the immigration, it's not only touching the immigrant refugee community, but it is touching all of us who are living in this country. And particularly this rally, it's geared toward the specific policy bill that are right now in the Congress. So in reality is that the policies that are really targeting the immigrant and refugees in this country has a historical perspective. Now, there is a bill, a specific bill that right now are in the Congress, which is actually called the Border Protection, Anti-Terrorism and Illegal Immigration Control Act, H.R. 4437. Also, usually people refer to as the Sunset Bernard's Bill. This bill was proposed to the House 11th hour of last year's Congress session, and it's already passed in the House. Now, the bill is will be discussed in the Senate next month or so. So this bill actually has a particularly amazing and really will have an impact both not only the immigrant and refugee community, but also average American who might be, you know, have a daily contact with the immigrant refugee community.
That was local activist Casey Jama speaking with KBOO's Lisa Loving. The Immigration Forum, Learning from the Past, Struggling for the Future, is Wednesday, March 1st at 7 p.m. at the SEIU Local 49, located at 3536 Southeast 26th Avenue in Portland. It's free and open to the public. The Rally for Immigration Rights is Saturday, March 4 at noon in Pioneer Courthouse Square. For more information about both events, go to www.interculturalorganizing.org or call 503-223-4464.
And the KBOO Standard Time is 5:17:27. And now for something completely different. Daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The national media swarmed all over the story of dead-eyed Dick Cheney bagging a Texas lawyer on a quail hunt. This would have been a one-day story, except for Cheney's insistence on always operating in skulking secrecy. First, he withheld all news of the shooting for nearly 24 hours. Even then, he handed off the task of facing the media to Catherine Armstrong, the lobbyist who was host of the Texas quail shoot. Dick himself had silently fled back to Washington. Second, Cheney's spinners tried to hide the seriousness of the shooting. Armstrong gaily reported that the victim had been peppered with a bunch of little bitty pellets. Excuse me, but you pepper eggs. A shotgun is loaded to kill, and one of those little bitty pellets lodged in the lawyer's heart. Third, Cheney's spinners rushed out to blame the victim. They scolded the lawyer for walking up behind Cheney without announcing his presence. Excuse me again, but the first rule of hunting safety is to look before you shoot. It wasn't the lawyer who pulled the trigger. It was Dead-Eye Dick. Fourth, it was four full days before Cheney was forced by mounting political pressure to come out of hiding and do what he should have done within hours of the shooting, take personal responsibility and publicly apologize. But there's a fifth story that the media has missed. The cost to the taxpayers for Cheney's little quail shoot. Flying to Texas on Air Force Two costs some $55,000 an hour. He also travels with a full Secret Service detail and a personal cardiologist, and an ambulance and EMS crew are with him at all times. Yes, Cheney needs to have some downtime, but are there no birds for him to kill in nearby Washington? This is Jim Hightower saying, while families are literally having to hold bake sales to buy armor for our troops in Iraq, Cheney is socking us for about $500,000 to go shoot quail. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News following our newscast. Then at 5:55, hear Independent Native News. Then at 6 p.m., hear Labor Radio. On tonight's show, host Don McIntosh talks with journalist James Lardner, founder of Inequality.org, about the growing economic divide in America. Also on the show, an interview with Tamara Drought, author of Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. That's all at 6 o'clock tonight on KBOO's Labor Radio. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Berry. Tonight's weather, cloudy with a chance of showers in the evening, then rain after midnight, lows around 40. Tomorrow, rain, highs around 45. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Fort Lewis Army officials have recommended a courts-martial for a Purple Heart recipient accused of killing his young wife by stabbing her more than 70 times. The July 12th killing happened after Specialist Brandon Barabara, a machine gunner with the 1st Brigade 25th Infantry Division, returned from Iraq after being wounded. At least two other Washington soldiers have been convicted of murdering their wives after returning from the war in Iraq. Bear is being held at the Post-Regional Correctional Facility. No trial date has been set. Yesterday, Fort Lewis officials said Bear may face charges in the military court as his case has been referred to by a general courts-martial. If found guilty, Bear faces a maximum of life in prison. On February 23rd, the Department of Defense launched a congressionally mandated program to increase awareness of domestic violence. Educational material about domestic violence will be distributed at military installations, and public service announcements will be made on military media outlets. The civilian rates for domestic assault are about 3.1 per 1,000 people, while military rates from the year 2000 before the Iraq War range from 18.6 to 25.6 per 1,000.
The construction of a five-story condominium in the Cathedral Park neighborhood of North Portland was halted by residents on January 28th. After informing police of their intent to stop construction, one dozen local residents marched to the site just uphill from Cathedral Park. Protesters told workers to stop and block trucks belonging to the excavation crew. The developer of the condominium, Eric Reistat, originally applied to build on the site in 2002. Reistat had attempted to renew the permit to allow construction at the Cathedral Park location. Locals against the plan argued the original permit expired in 2003. Since the permit was first issued, the Friends of Cathedral Park Neighborhood Association have worked with the city to develop the Lombard St. John's Vision Plan, which limits buildings to three stories. At a hearing last week, Reistat's permit was reinstated. Neighbors contend he should have been required to reapply, and will meet tomorrow at 8203 North Ivanhoe at 6 p.m. to plan further action.
The Hillsborough City Council agenda last week began with a discussion of possible changes to how parole group homes are managed. The proposals were touched off by neighbor complaints on parolees who live under the same roof at a residential neighborhoods. The proposal included finding landlords whose homes were who own homes where repeated calls to police are made, and requiring the new group homes have a live-in manager to monitor the property. If approved, the rules would take effect as early as this spring. The city began talks on the issue this year after residents on the Southeast 50th Avenue complained about a group of parolees living nearby. And last year, the city also faced complaints about how a home on Southeast Belmont Court that housed six registered sex offenders. After an eruption of protests, all the men moved out.
And that's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 27, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Tonight's assistant producer and audio editor was myself. Special thanks to reporters Lisa Loving and Spencer Raymond. Our engineer is John Delderfield. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Noah Eaton.
And I'm Andy Seaton. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. At 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. And at 7:30, it's Talk Radio with A. Proctor and Joe Uris. Guests include Melanie Sloan, Executive Director for Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. At 9, on Between the Covers, Ed Goldberg interviews G.M. Ford, a crime novelist set in Seattle. At 9:30, the focus on words and pictures is the Mohammed cartoon controversy, with international guest Chris Zeifer from Denmark and Al Jazeera editorial cartoonist Shujat Ali. Plus, Pulitzer Prize-winning Art Spiegelman weighs in on the debate. And at 10:15, we'll check in with Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine and author of The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. He'll be in Portland next week. At 10:30, on Stage and Studio, the focus is Our Fathers Who Aren't in Heaven, a look at an African-American son's relationship with his father. And at 11 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! And coming up on tomorrow, and that's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, February 27, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Abogado. On today's newscast, state governors head to Capitol Hill concerned about proposed reductions in funding. As Haitian President-elect René Préval prepares to take office, Canadian Haitians are demanding the withdrawal of troops. And the daytime curfew is lifted in Iraq following a week of widespread violence. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Philippine police today filed rebellion charges against 16 leftist and opposition personalities suspected of involvement in an alleged plot to oust President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo. Four police officers were also detained on the fourth day of an emergency rule. Gurlilina reports from Manila.
The widening crackdown was launched as legal experts challenged the legality of the state of emergency declared by President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo last week. This follows a six-hour standoff at a military camp in Manila on Sunday when Marines protested the relief of their commander after he was linked to the coup plot against Arroyo. Officials said police were continuing to hunt down various people believed to be involved in the coup plot. Today, six leftist congressmen were among 16 people charged with rebellion by police. Two of them have already been arrested, while the others have sought refuge in Congress. A former senator who led several coup attempts in the 1980s, four rebel soldiers and communist rebel leaders were also included in the complaint. But lawyer groups said the crackdown was illegal because Arroyo's emergency rule violates basic human and civil rights guaranteed by the Constitution. They've asked the Supreme Court to issue a restraining order on the president's declaration. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurlilinao in Manila.
The European Union says it will release financial aid earmarked for the Palestinian Authority, despite the Hamas electoral victory last month. Leila El-Haddad has more from Gaza.
The 25-nation bloc said most of the $142 million, which is being transferred before the Hamas government is officially sworn in, would bypass the Palestinian Authority. Instead, about one-third of the money would go directly to pay off energy bills, and roughly half is set to be channeled through the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. The rest, about $21 million, would help pay government wages, only a fraction of the $80 million needed. Since Hamas swept to power last month, international pressure has been mounting, with the Israeli government imposing a closure on Gaza and announcing it would withhold some $50 million in monthly tax revenues. International envoy James Wolfensohn warned that as a result of the sanctions, the Palestinian Authority could collapse in as little as 2 weeks, and that the financial crisis could lead to more violence and chaos unless a long-term funding plan was developed by the Middle East Quartet of International Mediators. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, this is Leila El-Haddad.
The International Court of Justice assembled today in The Hague for final hearings on a suit brought against Serbia by Bosnia. Zoran Chulafic reports from Belgrade.
The original lawsuit against Serbia was submitted in March 1993, less than a year after war in Bosnia started. The Bosnians claimed the Serbs intended to wipe out the entire Muslim population and create a mono-ethnic Greater Serbia, which according to international law constitutes the act of genocide. The final session began today after the 16-judge panel. The case represents one of the most complex and far-reaching rulings ever sought from the UN tribunal. Although some individual Bosnian Serbs have already been convicted on genocide charges for participating in the Srebrenica massacre, the ongoing case hinges on whether the court is persuaded that the Serbian state and not just a group of individuals had the specific intent to wipe out the Muslims of Eastern Bosnia as a distinct community. The arguments are scheduled to end by mid-May and the judges could take up to a year to deliver their verdict. If they rule in Bosnia's favor, it will be the first genocide verdict ever against one sovereign country. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zoran Čulavić in Belgrade.
Organized shack dwellers in Durban, South Africa scored a legal victory today. Naim Gina has the story.
Shack dwellers in Durban awoke this morning to police invading their homes and preventing people from moving out of the settlements. Four people were arrested. The early morning crackdown was because of plans by the shack dwellers' movement, Abaslali Basem Njondolo, to march in protest against the lack of housing and the poor delivery of basic services. But police were determined there would be no march and prevented people from leaving the camps. Although Abaslali had fulfilled all legal requirements to hold the march, police insisted it would be illegal and that their preemptive strike was justified. But Abaslali applied for an interdict to allow the march to proceed. By midday, the Durban High Court ruled the march had been and remained legal and interdicted police from in any way interfering with marches. Thousands of shack dwellers marched, thrilled that for once they had won a victory against a municipality that has consistently prevented them from protesting. In a country where there were 6,000 protests last year, civil society groups welcomed the judgment as a precedent for the right to protest by poor communities. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Naim Gina in Johannesburg.
A two-day shutdown strike crippled life in Indian-administered Kashmir over the weekend. Shanawas Khan reports from Srinagar.
While the shutdown strike on Saturday was largely peaceful, police used tear gas shells to disperse protesting mobs at many places on Friday. The two-day strike came on the heels of angry protests after Indian soldiers killed four youths in Indian-administered Kashmir last Wednesday. Protests continued through the weekend. The Indian Army says the four were killed in crossfire between the army and militants, a claim locals refute, alleging the soldiers fired without provocation. The state government has ordered a magisterial inquiry into the incident. The shutdown strike coincided with the first ever roundtable conference on Kashmir, chaired by Indian Prime Minister in New Delhi on Saturday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shanawas Khan.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
State governors are concerned with proposed reductions in funding the National Guard and Medicaid, two services that states rely on the federal government to provide for its residents. Governors met with the president today seeking answers but received few. And as Leanne Caldwell reports from Capitol Hill, budget analysts say that states should add an additional worry, cuts to discretionary spending such as education.
On the opening day of their convention in Washington, governors met with President Bush. The topic most important to him, national security. The topic most important to the governors, the National Guard. The president acknowledged their concerns.
Many of you have been overseas and have seen our Guard troops in action. And I can't thank you enough for not only supporting the troops in harm's way, but providing great comfort to their families as well.
The National Guard makes up nearly 40% of the troops in Iraq. That's a level expected to be maintained. Democratic Governor Thomas Vilsack from Iowa.
We were essentially told that as recruitment levels increase, somewhere, somehow, within the federal budget, the money will be found to pay for those increased troops. I'm a little bit skeptical of that. And I think we have reason to be skeptical.
The fiscal year 2007 budget proposed a reduction in spending on National Guard troops. The proposed budget would fund 20,000 less troops than current funding availability. Furthermore, with Guard reductions, governors said that the National Guard, whose duty is to the states, will not be available for state emergencies. Republican Governor Dirk Kempthorne from Idaho lists duties of the National Guard.
In Homeland Security, in the area of natural disasters, whether it be hurricanes, earthquakes, floods, fires, and then We hear from our Secretary of Health and Human Services talking about the possibility at some point in the future that you may see a pandemic. Well, again, they'll call upon the states to be the first responders, and we need to have the assets and the resources there to do so.
Also on governors' minds, Medicaid and Medicare. The president signed into law earlier this month the Deficit Reduction Act that would cut $30 billion from the federal Medicaid program. That cost will be transferred to the states. Democratic Governor John Baldacci from Maine.
So we're going to have to find resources. We're going to have to find collaborations at the state and local level. But we're going to take on, that's going to be an additional burden.
The president did not speak about this with the governors today. Health and Human Services Secretary Michael Levitt did, but offered no answers. As for Medicare, states are still seeing problems with the new prescription drug program. And as Iowa Governor Vilsack says, people not receiving their medicine will turn to the states for answers.
I think what's going to happen, and what we're fearful of what will happen, is that in the late summer, early fall, people go into the pharmacy and they'll say, I'd like to have my Lipitor, or I'd like to have my whatever. And the pharmacist will say, that'll be $95. And they'll say, well, here's my card. And the pharmacist will say, sorry, you've hit the donut hole. You got to pay me out of your own pocket.
Governors say states are just reemerging from a deep recession. Many states accumulated large debts and were forced to cut services and raise taxes. Even though their finances have improved, they say they aren't in the financial situation to take on the reduction of spending by the federal government. In addition to Medicaid, Medicare, and National Guard concerns, a topic not discussed, sure to hit states hard, are cuts to discretionary spending. The president's 2007 budget proposals cut discretionary programs by $16 billion, and nearly half of that is funding that goes to the states to pay for programs such as vocational education, special education, child care, and welfare-to-work programs. Iris Love is Deputy Director at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities.
That means a very significant shift in the partnership, the longstanding partnership between the federal government and the states. And that, you know, is going to be really important as we look to the future.
And in the five-year budget projection, cuts are expected to become even larger, totaling $183 billion, a large part which the states will have to compensate. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
And in other news from Capitol Hill, 18 House Democrats want the Bush administration to appoint a special counsel to investigate the domestic spying program and have sent a letter to President Bush suggesting that Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez open an investigation into the wiretapping program conducted by the National Security Agency. The lawmakers say that they are dissatisfied with the explanations they have been provided with so far, and that an investigation should confirm that no criminal laws have been broken. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan, however, maintains that the surveillance program is legal and no special counsel will be necessary. The Senate Judiciary hearing is expected to hold a hearing on the program tomorrow. The leader of Uganda's opposition, retired Colonel Dr. Kizza Besigye, is rejecting the results of the presidential elections that gave incumbent President Yoweri Museveni a 59% victory against him. Joshua Chilimpa reports from Kampala.
The commission declares Yoweri Kaguta Museveni elected president of the Republic of Uganda at the presidential election held on 23rd day, February 2006, signed by the whole commission.
Badu Chigwin, chairman of Uganda's Electoral Commission, declaring Yoweri Museveni the elected president of the Republic of Uganda after he obtained more than 50% of the valid votes cast in the February 23rd elections. Meanwhile, the leader of the opposition forum for democratic change, Kizza Besigye, has rejected the results and is insisting he is the winner.
Many voters on the voters' register could not vote, and harassment of voters and many other irregularities. We are therefore surprised that some international observers have endorsed this flawed process based solely on observations that they were able to make themselves on the polling day, completely ignoring the many reports that have been given to them and the evidence that we now have as to the extent of the irregularities.
Kizza Besigye was the main challenger to Museveni in last week's election. The first Ugandan woman to run for president, Maria Kaloleo Bote, has conceded defeat, but has this to say to Museveni.
stop the use and abuse of public resources to further the personal and political interests of the president and all his political party and cronies. End the two-decade-long fratricidal war in northern and parts of eastern Uganda. The people in these regions desperately need peace and a return to normal and decent lives in their homes. Undertake genuine and concerted efforts to stamp out the cancer of corruption in the country, which is being nursed by those in leadership and positions of influence.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Tamil Tiger rebels rejected outright Monday the Sri Lankan government's claim that the joint communique issued after the Geneva talks amounted to an amendment to the original ceasefire agreement between both parties. After returning home from Geneva, the government delegation told reporters Sunday that talks with the rebels were successful and the new obligations mentioned in the Geneva agreement of February 23 could be constructed as amendments to the ceasefire. The joint statement said the government and the rebels discussed issues concerning the welfare of children in the northeast, including the recruitment of children by the Tamil Tigers. But the government delegation pointed out this was not mentioned in the truce pact made 4 years ago, and it is therefore an amendment. Anton Balasingham, team leader of the rebel delegation, said the government's interpretation is ridiculous and unacceptable. Paniya Manikavasagam has more.
Norwegian Peace Envoy for Sri Lanka, Erik Solheim, said the government and the Tamil Tigers agreed over 2 days of talks in Geneva to meet again in April 19th to salvage their tattered truce. He said the talks were hard, but negotiators were able to maintain a sense of humor and the results went beyond his expectations. Minister Sri Pala De Silva headed the Sri Lankan government team during this first top-level meeting after 3 years.
As far as the talks are concerned, they were tough. We had to go through a very tough negotiation process, but we are happy that we could reach consensus on some issues.
A joint statement at the end of this first round of talks said the opposing sides agreed to ensure that there would be no intimidation, acts of violence, abductions or killings. In the northeastern parts of the island, over 200 combatants and civilians on both sides were killed 2 months ago due to the escalation of violence. Anton Balasingham, the political advisor to the Tamil Tigers, says the goal of the Geneva talks was to agree to better implementation of the ceasefire signed in February 2002.
Our discussion centered mainly on the activities of the Tamil paramilitary groups, and we have come to certain agreements. I would say that this is a remarkable achievement for the Tigers.
The new government wanted an amendment to the truce, which was signed by then Prime Minister and current opposition leader Ranil Wickremesinghe. But the Tamil Tigers rejected the idea. Political observers say the Geneva talks were a golden opportunity for the peace talks to continue, although the public was not assured that the two parties in conflict were completely genuine in their intent to maintain the ceasefire. P.S. Abdullah is a prominent trader and a member of the Truce Monitoring Committee in Vaunia.
It is the duty of the government to cease the arms from any group who is having illegal arms. That must be done. And they have agreed this matter in the Geneva conference. It should not prolong for a long time. Otherwise, again and again violation will start.
After the February 2002 agreement brokered by Norway, peace talks broke down in 2003 after 6 rounds of negotiations. The Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, or LTT, accused the government for reneging on points in the agreement and refrained from participating in further negotiations. Murugesu Chittamalam is a human rights lawyer and the chairman of the Bar Association, Vaunia. He says the agreement to continue the talks in April has given a sense of relief to the public.
The breather people have got till the next round of talks is a welcome sign. As things stand today, the minimum LTT is expecting from the government and the maximum the government of Sri Lanka could give to the LTT, there's a wide gap. So the negotiations will be a very long, drawn-out process. Until the talks are concluded in some way, a lasting peace during that negotiations must be there. The peace that will exist in the country will be the backbone of the talks.
Observers note the Geneva talks have saved the island nation from returning to war. Still, an uncertainty prevails as the nation is politically divided and the parties in the conflict have failed to build trust with each other. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
A daytime curfew was lifted in Baghdad as Sunni Arab leaders say they are considering returning to talks to form a new government after walking out last week following widespread sectarian violence in the wake of the destruction of a Shiite shrine north of Baghdad. The violence that shocked many Iraqis last week continued today, with at least 4 people killed in a mortar attack in a southern Baghdad neighborhood. In this report, produced and narrated by David Enders, Salon Talib speaks with residents in Baghdad about the violence and fears of civil war.
Faris Al-Abadi is a journalist working for All of Iraq, a news website based in Baghdad. On Friday, he described the violence that followed the destruction of the Askariya shrine in Samarra.
After the bombing of the shrine, which was on Thursday, you could see the armed people everywhere in the streets, and many of them were shooting randomly. It is a really difficult time in Baghdad. In the last 48 hours, 130 people have been killed. I went to the morgue in Baghdad, and I saw there was no place to put the bodies. It was full, and they had placed many bodies in the front yard of the morgue. Yesterday, they killed another 48 Shiite in Bakuba when they tried to go to the mosque to gather for a demonstration. So you can imagine that Baghdad and all Iraq may explode at any second. I work as an editor, and I cannot keep up with the news. It is overwhelmingly sad. I feel like Iraqi's blood is so cheap.
Shiites have endured past attacks against holy sites and figures without widespread violence. But some in Baghdad said the conflict had been growing more violent in the weeks leading up to the bombing and the retaliation. Ala al-Hashimiya lives in Harthiya, a mixed neighborhood in Baghdad. He said that the Sunnah mosque across the street from his house was burned.
For the last 2 weeks, the killings were everywhere. At my workplace, every day, 2 or 3 people have been getting killed. These are dark days. We have not faced days like this since the occupation began.
Many caution that Iraq remains on the brink of open civil war, an escalation of the guerrilla civil war that has been taking place for almost 2 years. Though Sunni leaders have said they would consider a return to talks to form the new government, no final agreement has been reached. The events that created the tensions that led to the violence are also not likely to go away. Following the attack on the Askariya shrine in Samarra, Shiite leaders accused of running Ministry of Interior commando units that have rounded up and killed and imprisoned Sunnis pointed to the attack as the reason they cannot give up control of the Ministry of Interior, which functions as sort of a national police force. Hardline Shiite parties giving up the MOI has been a frequent Sunni demand. Many Iraqis also fear what they are saying is the increased influence of clerics like Muqtada al-Sadr, whose Jaish al-Mehdi militia, which fought U.S. and Iraqi government troops in 2004, is blamed for many of the attacks on Sunni mosques. According to some news outlets, militiamen remained in control today of many of the Sunni mosques that were attacked and not destroyed. Sadr himself denied involvement of his militia and instead called for Iraqis to unite against occupation forces. All sides seem to blame the occupation in part for the destruction and the ensuing violence. Other news reports said Sunnis were fleeing some neighborhoods and that Shiite minorities in predominantly Sunni western Iraq were also fleeing. Though the daytime curfew in Baghdad was lifted, extended curfews remained in force throughout much of the country. I'm David Enders with Salam Talib reporting for FSRN.
At a public meeting held Monday at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australian Muslims and various community groups weighed in with their thoughts on how to heal the fractured and culturally diverse Australian society. Recent remarks by some prominent politicians referring to Australia's, quote, Muslim problem have done little to soothe public tensions after December's race riots in the Sydney beachside suburb of Cronulla. Just last week, Prime Minister John Howard stated that he believes there is a fragment of Muslim Australia that won't integrate into Australian society. FSRN's Cinema Napard has more.
Jarvis Ryan, spokesperson for the Sydney-based Stop the War Coalition, believes that the race riots in Cronulla are symptomatic of a country where Islamophobia is becoming more intense.
what we're really worried about is that since Cronulla there's been this rising racism. I think that Muslims are becoming the scapegoats for every issue. What we've got to try to do is to let Muslim people know that there are friends in the community, that many people in Australia don't support what's happening. And we also need to, I think, join up the dots a little bit, that the rise in racism against Muslims is connected with the war on terrorism. And John Howard says these people need to accept our values, but what are Australian values? You know, is it an Australian value to support America in its war on terrorism?
Australian Prime Minister John Howard has publicly stated that there are certain aspects of the Australian Muslim community that are antagonistic towards the West, holding attitudes that have made it more difficult for them to integrate into Australian society than previous waves of migration. But lawyer and executive member of the Islamic Council of Victoria, Waleed Ali, disagrees.
I think he's just got it wrong. The latest wave of migration is somehow fatally different from previous waves of migration. I mean, that's the kind of argument that's been used with every single wave of migration.
Federal Treasurer Peter Costello has also jumped on the bandwagon, saying that migrants who hold dual citizenship should have their Australian citizenship revoked if they don't respect Australian values and laws. Again, Waleed Ali.
Well, I think it's pretty hard to revoke someone's citizenship on the basis of their views. At least, if you're going to do that, it's very hard to claim that you're still a free society. I just think that using the whole citizenship argument's a bit of a furphy. You've got people with all sorts of unpalatable views among 6th and 7th generation white Australians.
The comments made by the Prime Minister and Treasurer are polarising Australians. But Kayser Trad from the Australian Islamic Friendship Association says the implications for Muslim Australians is particularly concerning.
This is most unfortunate for those Muslims who were born here, those Muslims who spent decades of their lives in Australia. We've always identified as Australian, and to find that a large section of Australian society is now making these disparaging remarks about us is very, very discomforting.
At a time when the Australian government is currently under investigation for its alleged involvement in a scandal involving the Australian Wheat Board paying kickbacks to Saddam Hussein's regime, one must ask if the Prime Minister's provocative comments are simply diversionary tactics for a government under fire. For Free Speech Radio News in Sydney, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
As President-elect René Garcia-Préval takes power in Haiti, he assumes control over a country that has been ravaged by violent political repression over the past 2 years. Foreign troops remain on the ground, but as FSRN's Aaron Lakoff reports from Montreal, activist groups in Canada are demanding troop removal and an end to interventions in Haiti.
On a brutally cold day, around 250 people came out in the streets of Montreal for a demonstration in solidarity with the Haitian people. The demonstration, which was organized by a coalition of Haitian-Canadian groups and their allies, came after a chaotic month in Haiti, which finally saw René Garcia-Préval named as president after many ballots were found destroyed and burned outside of Port-au-Prince. 2 years ago, Canada sent 550 soldiers to Haiti to help secure the country for the removal of Aristide. Aristide himself calls his removal a kidnapping. Marie-Claire Jumel, a Haitian activist in Montreal, explains why this demonstration was so important.
During the last few years, there's been total chaos in Haiti, but it's a total chaos that's been organized by Canada, France, and the United States. There's genocide taking place in Haiti and political prisoners in prison. When it comes to Canada, I'm here to demand that Canada get out of Haiti because it has no business being there.
Other activists were turning their anger to Canadian NGOs who have yet to take clear positions on Haiti. Eve Engler, activist and co-author of the book Canada and Haiti, explains.
Well, basically, integral part of Canadian imperialism in Haiti is the Canadian government-financed so-called non-government organizations. And these groups have done their part in providing the ideological cover for the Canadian government.
Even though Préval, seen by many as the popular choice of the Haitian people, was declared victorious, many are saying that the struggle in Haiti is not over. Jean St. Ville of the Ottawa Haiti Solidarity Committee, who was at the demonstration in Montreal.
So there's an opportunity there, and with enough solidarity building up outside with the Haitian diaspora, with the peace movement around the world, as we have seen developing in Canada, we think that the next step, for instance, which will be the financial battle, because we know the IMF and the World Bank have already prepared their little plan with the illegal puppet government that was in power.
Meanwhile, foreign troops under the UN are due to stay in the country until August 2006. This is Aaron Lakoff reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Montreal, Canada.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.
This is Independent Native News for Monday, the 27th of February, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In New Mexico, a 40-year-old lawsuit involving four pueblos near Santa Fe, as well as 2,000 other defendants, could finally be nearing a settlement. Correspondent Eric Mack has the story.
The suit was filed in 1966 by the state to settle the water claims of the Powake, Tusuque, Nambe, and San Ildefonso pueblos, as well as non-natives in the Powake Valley. After 5 years of negotiation, all of the parties involved now have until April 30th of this year to approve a settlement to avoid going to trial in federal court. Peter Chestnut is an attorney representing the San Ildefonso Pueblo in the case. He says the current settlement on the table includes a compromise between Pueblo and non-native water rights.
In return for construction of new water systems for each of the Pueblos and a regional water system to import water from the Rio Grande, the Pueblos agreed to limit the exercise of their senior first priority against junior non-Indian right holders to some extent.
Chestnut says the case represents a landmark in Pueblo water rights, but does not necessarily set a precedent for all other tribes.
This is the leading case to determine the nature and extent of Pueblo Indian water rights, and the federal courts have determined that they're rooted in the Pueblo's aboriginal sovereignty, and they're measured differently than those of other Indian tribes in the country.
If the settlement goes forward, it will require both state and federal approval. The agreement includes a timeline to have the water projects essentially complete by 2016. A public information meeting on the settlement will be held in Powake tonight. For Independent Native News, I'm Eric Mack.
In Boulder, Colorado, a site sacred to Native Americans has been given a reprieve from developers. Correspondent Maeve Conran has details.
Valmont Butte is a site of ecologic and historic importance, as well as being sacred to Native Americans. The city of Boulder was considering plans to locate a fire training center and a biosolids recycling center on the butte. The proposals angered Native Americans, who still attend ceremonies at the Sweat Lodge located there. Native Americans, including members of the Arapaho and Lakota tribes, joined environmentalists and local historians to oppose the council's plans ever since the city purchased the site in 2000. On Tuesday, Boulder City Council announced that it will put the fire training center at another location in South Boulder. Since a Sweat Lodge ceremony on New Year's Eve 2003 was disrupted by local police, the City of Boulder has allowed Native Americans to hold ceremonies on the butte, which is part of city open space. For Independent Native News, I'm Maeve Conran in Boulder, Colorado.
In Canada's Yukon Territory, Wet'suwet'en Chief Joe Linklater is packing his bags as he gets ready for yet another trip to Washington, D.C. to fight against oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Last week, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski promised to try once again to hitch a vote on oil drilling to an overall vote on the U.S. budget. Last year, similar tactics failed by a slim four-vote margin, and Murkowski says she'd be crazy not to try again. And that means Linklater and three other Wet'suwet'en citizens will be making the trek to Washington, where they'll be knocking on politicians' doors, urging them to protect the area for the caribou herd the Gwich'in depend on.
It came close last time, so we need that grassroots support now more than ever. That's all we do all day long, is just hit the hill and go to the Senate side, if that's where we're needed, or the House Representative side, and we do whatever we can to to convince them to do the right thing.
Linklater says he's expecting a vote could come in early March, and he's planning to be in Washington before that happens. He says he's also expecting a Gwich'in contingent from Alaska, and perhaps even the Northwest Territories will also make the trip to try and convince politicians about the need to protect caribou. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. And by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC.